Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Jeffrey Swartz. I'm a professor of law at Cooley Law School's Tampa Bay campus. And this is the Constitution Today and anything else we want to talk about, which is a lot of different things. And I'm here with my compatriot, Brendan Beery, who is also, by happenstance only, a professor of law at Cooley Law School, Tampa Bay campus. And I am supposed to say and will say at the beginning of this broadcast that everything and the opinions that Brendan and I say and espouse on this program are ours and ours alone, except for the ones that we share, and are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of Cooley Law School or its faculty at large or individually. Good morning, Brendan. Are you there, Brendan? Am I there?
You're there. Hello? And except
where's
his
Brendan?
Phone line is on, but maybe he's he had to step away for a moment from the phone.
Well, Brendan doesn't normally step away, so he carries his phone with him. So something that you may have lost him. I don't know. Are you telling me his line is still there?
His line is still here. It shows that it's on.
Okay. Well, then we'll wait and see what happens if and when he comes back. The voice that you are hearing is our patron and all-around good guy. It's the Hez. Good morning, Hez.
Good morning. What a pleasure.
Everything okay?
Oh, you know, it seems everything's okay, but for some reason we just lost Brendan. So he's probably going to call back.
He'll call.
Maybe he wasn't
here. He'll call back in. Everything will be right. But while he's gone, we start, basically at the start of every show, Brendan and I have something that we talk about. What do we really think? And I've been debating what to talk about. And I have kind of reached a point where today I have no choice but to open up with one of our favorite members of the United States Supreme Court, Justice Samuel Alito. And as many of you know, Justice Alito is one of those who has been under attack together with Justice Thomas for playing, for lack of a better way to put it, fast and loose with the ethical requirements of his job. He shows an incredible depth of either misunderstanding or what we call conscious denial of knowledge of what the requirements of his job are. And I have said many times that if you cannot live on your $287,000 a year salary as a member of the United States Supreme Court, if you cannot survive to and from court and having in a suburban with Secret Service protection, if you cannot survive Secret Service protection around your home, if you can't survive on this, then don't be on the court. Being a member of the judiciary is really, having been a member of the judiciary, I can tell you, was never really designed to be a career. It was designed to be a way to end your career, a way to pay back for all that the profession has given to you. And there's this thought process now that we have this lifetime appointment and we're putting people that are in their 40s on federal courts or even local courts who all they want are the salary and the benefits and the retirement. And look at their job, or look at what they do as a job. They don't look at it as a calling. And it's sort of like, and I'm not saying that they're like priests, but priests and rabbis and people in religious positions take on those positions as a calling. And being a judge has got to be a calling. It can't be an easy gig. It can't be for all of the recognition. I've always felt that way. And so Alito, who has been resoundingly criticized, and between him and Thomas and a couple of other disclosures, including the Chief Justice, has brought the Senate Judiciary Committee to the point of proposing a bill establishing a new ethical code for them and new disclosures that are going to be required. So instead of getting million-dollar vacations on billionaires' airplanes and yachts, or hunting trips and fishing trips that other people would pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to go on, being given to them by people who have matters of their interest or directly related to the parties who are of interest in front of them, and then staying on the cases, not disqualifying themselves, saying, wait a minute, you know, I am a personal friend. I have received gifts and benefits from these people. I cannot be part of any judgment on their cases. They stay on the case. Whether it is Clarence Thomas sitting in the Garden of Dictators, smoking cigars and being with his buddies, white supremacist, neo-Nazi billionaires, or whether it's Sam Alito being friends with people who have ongoing business in front of the Supreme Court and going on fishing trips that cost a fortune, more than some people make in 3 years of working, it's wrong. It's utterly and completely wrong. And yet he goes to the Wall Street Journal and writes op-eds defending what he does and claiming the people that are exposing him are being untruthful. And 4 days ago, he wrote another one that said, Congress, stay out of our business. You have no business telling the Supreme Court what they can and can't do because our court was created in the Constitution. And there's nothing in the Constitution that gives Congress power of any kind over the Supreme Court. Really? We have checks and balances, but you aren't checked and you aren't balanced? That's why you get your money from Congress. That's why you get your pay raises and your pay from Congress. That's why you get judges you ask for from Congress. Everything you need to survive on comes from Congress. The Constitution creates the court. It did not create autonomy in the context that you answer to no one. Here, the Supreme Court answers to the people. And you have no business telling Congress what they can and cannot do unless it violates the Constitution. They're telling you what your ethical obligations are as a member of the Supreme Court. They're going to tell you that. And you're going to have to comply, or you're going to be impeached. And you know that that's what's going to happen to you. If they pass this code, they can't impeach members of the court for what they've done before it became part of the code. But if in the future, Thomas and Alito and the Chief Justice Roberts and anybody else on that court fail to report sit on cases where they have received gifts from people, then they're going to be impeached and they're going to be removed. That's the check and the balance. How do you impeach a member of the court? You can't right now because you can't get information to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the truth. And so, Justice Alito, what you're basically saying to everybody is I am a god. Don't mess with me. And I think people have to start messing with the Supreme Court in the context of making sure they do their jobs. And if you don't want to do the job for $287 a year, then you know what? Resign, go to work for a firm, and make a living that way. It's just wrong. And we're going to stick our nose into the controversy. And don't you tell us not to. Okay? Or you might not get a pay raise. You may get a pay cut. See how long you last. That's a way of making sure. I mean, he is just stunningly wrong, in the words of Congressman, or I'm sorry, Senator Chris Murphy. It's just stunningly wrong for a member of the court to say Congress has no constitutional rights here. And that's what I think today. Did we ever get Brendan
back?
Brendan's
been back. He's been hearing
me
all the time. Yes,
I can hear you. It's so good to hear you, Brendan.
Yeah,
good morning.
Yeah, I don't know what happened earlier, but I was talking and nobody was hearing me. So.
No, what were you doing?
I was talking. I was answering you.
I'm just giving you a laugh like that. What were you doing? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, God.
What were you doing, Brendan? Okay.
Yeah.
Were you vacuuming?
No, I was answering you. I was talking to you, and nobody was hearing me.
That was
frustrating.
That was probably something wrong. I'm glad that you hung up and then called back. I don't know what was the reason we didn't hear you the first time.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Well, welcome to my.
I saw your number
maybe
on.
You just admit, maybe it was your mute button.
No, I looked at that. Right.
You looked at that? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
I tried everything.
I got the show started. Okay.
Good.
Why don't
good.
You
yeah,
jump
heard,
in here and say something?
I heard most of it.
You're
going to be surprised. You're going to be surprised. I agree. I agree with you. And I do think it's bizarre for a Supreme Court justice to argue preemptively that the Congress has no role in regulating the court. As you mentioned, I mean, it's Congress that decides how many justices will be on the court. Congress funds the court. Congress determines when the court will sit. I might add that the Constitution says that Congress regulates the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. So Congress can take away their jurisdiction to hear cases and has done that before. It is certainly true, you know, that the core function of the judicial branch is to decide cases. And it's certainly true, and the Supreme Court has had to remind Congress in the past, that Congress does not get to tell the court how to decide cases. That's true. But that's not what's going on here. Congress is not telling the court how to decide cases. Congress is telling the, or should at least be telling the court, as you said, you know, what ethical obligations any federal judge has. Incidentally, all of the courts inferior to the Supreme Court are created by Congress. They can be, they can be destroyed by Congress. Congress can get rid of them. So, I mean, the suggestion, I mean, it's almost as though a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court never took constitutional law. I mean, it's that ignorant, right, to suggest that Congress has, you know, Congress can't do anything to the court. I agree.
That's like the kids who live in their parents' basement saying, you can't tell me what to do.
Right.
You can't tell me. You can't. Okay. You're feeding me, and you're clothing me, and you're putting a roof over my head, but you can't tell me what to do.
Right.
Yeah, I can. Get out.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And there, I told you what to do. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
I'm sorry. My father, I mean, I remember as a teenager, you know.
Yeah.
You know, my father would give me an allowance. He gave me a car. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I worked during the summers and made my own money. And he would say, you know, I don't want you doing this and I don't want you doing that. I said, you can't tell me what to do. Okay. He said, give me your keys.
Right.
You can walk to, mm-hmm. anywhere you want to go. Okay.
Right.
Sorry, it doesn't work that way. Okay.
Right.
So what else is on, what's on your mind you want to start out with?
Yeah, we talked earlier today.
We did.
As always.
Giving it away again.
And we both saw a story that certainly caught my attention last night, and that is that Uganda has enacted a law making it a crime to be homosexual and imposing the death penalty.
Really?
Yeah, Uganda. And that's a country that receives hundreds of millions of dollars in aid from the United States, mostly to fight AIDS, kind of ironically.
Yeah.
I think the United States has to seriously reconsider whether it's as laudable as it is to be helping. And, you know, it's one of the few things that George W. Bush did right when he was president was to initiate this program to fight AIDS in Africa, which has saved millions and millions of lives. And as laudable as that is, a country that now thinks that it can get away with this kind of inhumane, barbaric lawmaking should probably not be receiving any American assistance at all for anything. And to the extent that the argument can be made, you know, that, well, that's punishing the people of Uganda for their government, my reply would be that's correct. The people of Uganda are ultimately responsible for their government. And if they're going to tolerate this kind of thing, or indeed if they're going to support it, if they actually, if it's the popular will that is reflected in this new law, then the people of Uganda should know that they're on their own. You're on your own, kind of like what Jeff just said about, right? Give me the keys and
walk wherever you want to go.
Yeah, go do whatever you want, but you're not going to do it with American dollars. So we'll see what the Biden administration does. But there's a few things about this that really bother me. One is that we'd be kidding ourselves not to realize that there are plenty of people in this country who would like to see the same thing if they could get away with it.
Yeah.
I have a memory.
Especially
kind of feared
in the state of Florida.
Absolutely. I remember watching a movie. What was it called? Sacha Cohen was the is the actor in it. Borat. I don't know if you saw that movie.
Borat.
And he had a, you know, he went into character and he would you know, his shtick was going into, you know, parts of the United States where people didn't realize who he was and getting them to say things out loud. Right, that, you know, that they wouldn't say.
Yeah,
example,
one of them was Rudy Giuliani.
Right. Yeah.
What, was he laying on a bed or something, doing something? I can't remember what he had him doing.
Right. And, but.
Should have been a big hint.
Yeah. And there was another, I'll never forget, he went, you know, he liked spending time in the Deep South, too, and, you know. I realize that people in the Deep South don't like being, you know, painted with a broad brush. and not all of them should be, obviously, but that's where this guy went and hung out a lot, and he was asking people what you should do with gays. And I'll just never forget that these people, when they didn't realize that they were talking to somebody who was going to put them right their statements on the air, they thought they were talking to a friendly. They proposed that gay people should be hung. And executed. And so, yeah, they're, you know, it's not like we don't have this level of barbarism in the United States, and probably in larger numbers than when we'd like. So that's one of the things that's depressing to me about it. Another thing is, it got me to thinking, what is it with these people, these extremists, whether they're in Uganda or they're here or they're anywhere else, that they are incapable of just leaving other people alone? You know, Louis Brandeis, who was a Supreme Court justice, once, you know, said that that's the greatest right that we have, when it comes down to it, is the right to be let alone.
Individuality. He talked about in terms of the right of individuality.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So be who you are. Live your, don't hurt anybody else, right? Don't cause a whole lot of trouble.
Right.
But otherwise, go about your business, and we'll leave you alone. What is it with these people, these DeSantis and Trump, and all that crowd, that they can't just leave people alone to live their lives? Leave women alone. Leave gay people alone. You don't have to believe or do anything that you don't want to in your own life. You are not to impose your own dogmas on everybody else. What is so difficult about that? And the irony is that they call themselves small government conservatives, who want to intrude into the most intimate places in people's lives.
Who actually believe in one important thing, freedom. That's what they believe in. They believe in freedom as long as they are free.
Exactly. Free to impose.
Okay.
Right.
They have the right to impose, they have the freedom to impose their views on someone else. And they think they have this by misquoting the First Amendment to the United States Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
I can say whatever I want to say, even if it acts in a way to impose my will upon you and take away your freedom. That's the problem we have. They're misconceptions more than anything else of what the Constitution says. They don't want to know what it really means. They just want to be able to take a sentence. I know too many people who know how to take one or maybe four or five words in the middle of a sentence from the Constitution and say, that's what it really means. Really?
Mm-hmm.
There's no concept of contextualizing anything. There's no ability to put a context on what people say. It is the actual word or words. And that's a problem. You know, but we get back. I digress into the educational system in the United States. I'm not going to get into that today. But that's the real problem here. So, no, I agree with you on all that. But going back to the situation with Uganda, I thought Idi Amin had died.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It appears his ghost is resurfacing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, yes, we have to do Uganda. I don't see where Uganda serves any purpose for the United States in any way, shape, or form. It serves no purpose to this country in the context of our national security or providing anything. It does nothing for us. Yet out of the goodness of our hearts, we give them money because we want to see them live better. Probably more out of our national guilt than anything else. And in return for which, they do everything to put, to basically say, we don't care about you, just send us your money. Russia can't afford to replace the money to get in. Russia's not going to do anything for them other than colonize. So, yeah, something's got to change. But they have always, the problem has always been in Africa, the idea of what we talk about as tribalism is their way of life. And because of that, there is always differences among their tribes. So I don't know what you do about it. But Uganda serves no purpose for us. And I don't know why we spend that kind of money if they are not going to promote our ideals and our thought process of freedom. And I'll just leave it at that. I happen to agree with you. The death penalty for being gay? Really? We've limited the death penalty to certain crimes in this country, and even that's under attack and probably shouldn't be anymore. It just doesn't work. You're going to stop people from being gay because you're going to kill them. And then you'll decide which you'll kill and which ones you won't. No. It's like ethnic cleansing. So, all right. Let's move on to something else. We've got to talk about Dunham. We've got to talk about the new indictment. We absolutely have to talk about this.
Yep.
Today,
we got a new indictment, just not the one we thought we were going to get last Tuesday.
Right. That's precisely it. It is hysterical to me that Donald's lawyers showed up to talk to Jack and his people about what to expect coming out of the grand jury in Washington in hopes of convincing them not to indict him now, wait till after the campaign, because if he doesn't get elected, you can go after him then. You know, anything to stall off until the campaign's over. And not realizing, and of course, Jack's people realize, we're talking about this, but wait till you later today. We'll see you later today, okay? We're not going to tell you about that, okay? But there's something coming, okay? You know, I think they left it with the idea basically of telling Donald, okay, go back and tell your client. We'll take into consideration what you said, but he should expect an indictment. That wasn't the indictment they were talking about.
Right.
And I talk about getting a misconception in a conversation. This indictment, I think people have made much more of it than it really is and have lost what the import of it is. There were issues relating to the video that Jack had being used without putting it into context and without and the things that may have been said in bringing in testimony regarding it, where they didn't have anybody directly relating to it to attach it to Donald, because they don't see Donald moving boxes, they see other people moving boxes, and so they needed to bring Donald into it to make that video that they had admissible at a trial involving Donald Trump, and that was important. And so I think that people need to understand there were evidentiary issues that needed to be resolved. Excuse me. I think that there are other evidentiary issues which will now surface as a result of this, because as we talked earlier, there is a hue and cry that it still doesn't put Donald directly involved in the movement. There are circumstances that are created and a circumstantial case to be made, but we still don't know exactly what was said in a 24-minute conversation with D. Oliveira. who is the property manager who started out 20 years ago as a valet at Mar-a-Lago, working for Donald. He's an American citizen born in Portugal. And he has risen, I guess the best way to put it, to his the Peter Principle, to his highest level of incompetence with Donald, and is fully ingratiated to Donald for his living and for his survival. I just have a problem with the idea that we do not know exactly what was said during that conversation. And the only evidence they have is an out-of-court statement made by Donald to Oliveira and to, what's his name, Knott. Basically, the boss wants us to erase the video. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a rule of evidence that will allow that to be introduced if the government can prove a prima facie case of a conspiracy. And it's Section 801 of the Rules of Evidence, which is called the co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule. And that is that anything that is said by a co-conspirator in furtherance of the conspiracy is admissible against all conspirators, including the person who allegedly said it. That is the thing that was repeated, the hearsay. It is a rule that is still subject to another rule known as Rule 403, which is the probative value of that testimony outweighed by its prejudicial value? And that will be the objection that will be made to the application of Rule 801. It is a close call right now. And if it is a close call, I don't want that close call in front of loose cannon, or some people refer to as Judge Aileen Cannon. And so it is important at this point that not just the person these things were said to, that's a guy named Tavares, who is identified in the indictment as employee number 4. He was their IT guy, who refused to do what he was told to do, erase the server. And he is the only tie right now, him to the other two, to Donald. And it is remote enough that there could be an evidentiary problem here. Tavares got a target letter, and he immediately went, nope, 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 don't want anything to do with this, nope. Sorry, not going to do it. And he goes running in and telling Jack everything Jack wants to know. And he was amply rewarded. He was not indicted. He was named in the indictment, but he was not a named defendant. He's an unindicted co-conspirator. I'm not even sure he's a co-conspirator because he never agreed to do what he was asked to do.
Right.
So where's the agreement? So I don't know that there was. He is involved in the conspiracy. A conspiracy involves two things: an agreement about between one or more persons to do an illegal act. That's it. The agreement is the conspiracy, not doing the thing they agree to, but the agreement to do it. And it looks like Tavares never agreed. So he was in pretty good shape. He had other problems because the first time he talked to the feds, he lied.
Mm-hmm.
Said, I don't know nothing about nothing. Okay, and that was a lie. So he had a problem for lying to the FBI or to the prosecutors. But there are still evidentiary holes that need to be filled. De Oliveira, Oliveria, however you pronounce it, he needs a new lawyer, and he's looking for a new lawyer. Okay? Look in my direction, sir. I'm volunteering to represent you. for free. As long as my agreeing to represent you is conditioned upon my job is to get you the best plea I possibly can at this point and arrange for your cooperation with the government. I will do everything I can to keep you out of jail, short of going to trial. I will sit for hours, if necessary, with the prosecutors to make sure that you get a good plea offer, something that minimizes the amount of time that you will have to spend in jail, because you are going to go to jail. You've lost your opportunity to get out of this without any exposure, jail exposure. You've been indicted now. They're not going to let you out of this for free. It isn't going to happen. But I'll get you a year and a day, which means you do 9 months in a club fed somewhere where you can work on your backhand. Okay? I will get you a good plea. I will get you a queen for a day, in which you will walk in front of those prosecutors and tell them everything that was said on that 24-minute call. Everything you were directed to do by Donald. And I will do this for free. Or you and Mr. Naught can go to trial with Donald and listen to the following opening statement from Donald's lawyers, because Donald ain't going to testify. These two other gentlemen over here, in their loyalty to the former president, went too far. They did this all on their own to try to protect the person they were loyal to. But the former president did nothing wrong and directed no one to do anything. And no evidence you're going to hear, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, will directly relate the former president of the United States to the actions of these two gentlemen. And the closing argument will be the same. The train is coming down the tracks, and it's going to run you over, both of you. And you will go to jail for years. And you will be the fall guy. If you don't believe me, talk to Michael Cohen. Loyalty only goes one way with Donald Trump. You are to be loyal to him. Your loyalty includes falling on your sword and taking any punishment that comes your way in lieu of him. Do not believe he will support your family. Do not believe he will support you. Because once it's over, the check's in the mail. Oh, I forgot to put a stamp on it. That's what's coming your way, and you need to understand that. Your days at Mar-a-Lago are numbered, and you need a good lawyer who will represent you, not join in a joint defense agreement with Donald's lawyers. And you need to go your own way and protect yourself. Now, I'm not going to put my phone number on the line right now, but you can find me through the Florida Bar, okay? And it won't cost you. All it costs you is the dime that you had to spend to make the phone call. What do you think about that, Brendan?
Yeah. The ethical choices of the lawyers who Donald Trump is paying to represent these two, those choices are going to have to come under some scrutiny at some point. because whoever is representing, especially De Oliveira, are not serving his interests. They're serving somebody else's interests. And that obviously is a real ethical issue. I also, you know, I'm getting tired of asking this question, right? How many people are going to have to be destroyed in Donald Trump's wake before the other people who remain in his orbit wake up? He is the destroyer of lives and reputations. He just leaves a trail of destruction. The lawyers who represent him always wind up in trouble. The people who work for him always wind up in trouble. You know, how many lawyers have to get disbarred or disciplined because they associated themselves with Donald Trump before other lawyers start saying, I don't know about that. The things that this guy's going to ask me to do.
I think the key to look at in that context is talk to the lawyers who said no.
Right, exactly.
Talk to the lawyers in this country who have said no to representing Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And then take a look at the ones who said yes.
Right.
And where are they? Unpaid and off the case.
Right.
Some of them named as are allegedly found to be disbarred or charged as co-conspirators. And I've talked a number of times about a friend of mine down in Miami, John Sale, who just said no to millions of dollars. Said no to millions of dollars in fees because his good name, his license, his freedom was more important to him than the millions of dollars that Donald would have paid him. Of course, Donald doesn't pay. If the fee is supposed to be $3 million, flat fee, because criminal defense lawyers get flat fees and get paid in advance. And why would they do that? Because the people they're representing are crooks. It's like you're going to take a check from a guy who's charged with worthless checks.
Right.
Yeah, there you go. That's what I'm going to do. Here, yeah, you can give me a check. And I'm going to file a notice of appearance in the SDFL, and I'm stuck. I can't get out for not getting paid. He doesn't pay. How many millions of dollars does he owe to lawyers that have withdrawn and he's not paying? Even with the $40 million he supposedly has paid out of his PAC, by the way, the PAC that now is asking for $60 million back from people they gave it to for campaign purposes because they needed to pay attorney's fees for Donald and all the other lawyers he's hired. He doesn't pay. That's why his accounting firm quit. His law firms have quit. Nobody wants to work for him. They're on to him, and they don't work for him. And the truth of the matter is, I don't understand why anybody else would sign up for this. He'll make all kinds of promises of cooperation and everything else, and when the time comes, it ain't there. Well, it was just hyperbole. My cooperation is hyperbole. Okay. I just don't understand why people do business with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand why people are still giving him money.
Right.
To pay his, now he's raising it flat out as a defense fund. He's not even pretending it's for the campaign. He's out and out asking people to give him money to pay for his attorney's fees. This guy is a frigging billionaire, and he needs other people to pay his attorney's fees. Really? To defend him in a civil lawsuit? for the second time with E. Jean Carroll.
Mm-hmm.
Because he doesn't know when to lose and go away. Why do these people keep giving him money? Because you don't want to admit you're wrong. That's why. They don't want to admit they're wrong. They don't want to. The person, the last person to say the con man is guilty is the person who got conned. Because they don't want to admit they've been conned. I just don't understand. And I will never understand that thought process. How much do you have to hear until you realize you've been conned? The grift. I just don't know. But I'm working for free for you, D. Oliveira. Give me a call. I'm a member of the SDFL, and I will pay for my own transportation to go to the East Coast when I need to. I'll put miles on my car. I'll pay for my own gas. I will do anything I can to help you for just that one purpose, though. I won't file a notice of appearance until there is a solid agreement. And then I'll file the notice of appearance, and I'll walk you into court, and I'll represent you in front of Jack Smith's people. I'll pay my own airfare to go to Washington, if that's where I got to go to meet with his people. I will consider it my contribution to the American experiment. Want to go with me, Brendan?
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah. Would you buy my ticket too, though?
No, I will not buy my ticket.
Okay.
Okay, but if you want to come along, I'll book the flights together so to make sure we're on the same flights, okay?
Yeah,
or I'll give
you
a ride in my car. I won't even charge you for, you know, the extra gas it costs to have someone else in my car with me.
Yeah.
Okay?
I'm not sure I want to ride in your car. If anybody's ever seen Jeff drive, I think I'll pass on that.
Don't go there. Don't go there, Brendan.
if
I want people to talk about the way I drive, I'll bring Marilyn on and have
there you
her
go.
Talk
right.
about how I drive. How's that sound? Okay. Sometimes she just lowers her head and closes her eyes, okay?
Right.
And I'm driving her car. She says, "You're driving my car, not yours."
Right, right.
Okay. You can see we lower her eyes and just close her eyes and lower her head as we go over the Sunshine Bridge.
Right.
She's so afraid that we're going right over the edge, okay?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
We go to what do you call it? A beach mountain. And when you go up to the climb beach mountain in a car, it's the old style switchbacks. You know, you climb for a while and then you make these almost 180-degree turns and go back the other way climbing, and you know, it's the old switchback
thing.
And she just hates it.
She just
hates that ride. And especially when I'm driving. But that's because I enjoy it.
Right.
But you're not supposed to have fun doing that. So
that's
something we're talking about. Okay. You can add anything you want to what I've just said. You don't have to volunteer, though, okay?
Yeah, no. Well, I'm not licensed in Florida, so I'm not gonna be of much use. But, that's well. Speaking of Florida, should we talk about the disintegration of our best friend's presidential campaign?
Yeah, you're talking about the new Saint Michael?
Yeah,
the archangel. Okay,
mm-hmm.
okay. Okay, he was charged with protecting heaven. Okay, God's number one soldier.
Mm-hmm.
That's when he wanted to get rid of Lucifer. Okay, when he wanted to get rid
right.
of that archangel, it was Michael who was sent to throw Lucifer into the pit and lock him up down there. I know a little bit about the Old Testament. And I refer to Governor DeSantis or DeSantis, depending on the day and who he's talking to, you know, for what purpose. When we said this, his campaign many years ago, back in that, we're talking like 50 years ago, actually 52 years ago, I was working on a campaign for a guy named Edmund Muskie,
mm-hmm.
who was a senator from the state of Maine. He was the leading candidate for the Democratic nomination. He had been the vice presidential candidate 4 years before with Hubert Humphrey. Okay, and I know nobody knows who Hubert Humphrey was. But Hubert Humphrey was the candidate in 1968 who took the Democratic nomination after Bobby Kennedy died
mm-hmm.
or was killed. I don't want to say he died. He was murdered. And he was the leading candidate, and he went to New Hampshire for the primary, and the publisher, the Manchester Leader, I think it is, I think that's the name of the paper, said some very unkind things about Ed Muskie's wife. And Ed Muskie got very disturbed about it and gave a speech, and as he was defending his wife, he started crying. And in 1972, it was unseemly for a president or a presidential candidate to cry about anything. You were supposed to have the stoicism of the Queen of England. The only emotion you were allowed to show was anger. And that even had to be muted. And he started to cry, standing out in the cold with the snow falling on him. I can remember watching it on TV like it was yesterday, and he's crying. And everybody who worked for him in his campaign, there were three of us that actually were in charge of the statewide campaign for him, myself and a guy named Tim Foran, who is a lawyer who does public service work down in Athens, Ohio, and Barney Frank,
mm-hmm.
former congressman who at that time worked for mm-hmm. Congressman Harrington. And we showed up at work the next day, and Barney walked in with his suitcase, which apparently had been packed because he had sleeves and pants legs hanging out the sides of this suitcase like a cartoon. Barney was not known for style, and to say the least. And he came in, and we sat, and he said, "I'm going back to Washington. This campaign is over." Mm-hmm. And in the space of a week, Muskie's campaign was gone. He was gone as a candidate. That was it. And opened the door for McGovern. I wish he hadn't walked through the door, but he did.
Mm-hmm.
And I liken what is happening to DeSantis, a slow-motion Muskie, in the context that this guy cannot do anything right. He literally can't. He can't say anything right. He cannot equate to people in any way. He has burned through money in a way that no primary candidate, especially in Iowa, should be a place he's not going to win, has burned through money. Instead of flying commercial, which a lot of candidates do, or traveling by bus, which he's sort of doing in Iowa now, he's flying on private airplanes. He had a staff that was four times as large as Donald Trump's, and he was burning through money like he was the heir apparent, and this was going to be his nomination, and everybody is a bigot like me. Everybody is a fascist like me. and he was running his campaign like Hitler did in 1929. And now he can't raise any money. Now he's short on cash. Now he's gotten rid of at least one-third, maybe up to one-half of his total staff. He's riding on a bus. And he's trying to get traction, but he can't. Because even when he tries to get traction on issues other than his wokeism, he can't get anybody to pay attention to him. They listen to his wife. She's the brains of the outfit. But even she can't get any traction. No matter where she goes, she's imitating some other first lady, whether it was Kennedy, whether it's Melania. She just wants to imitate these people. I want to look like the pretty one. You want me to be your first lady, kind of thing. This is their campaign. He'll be lucky to finish second in Iowa. He is not going to win New Hampshire, and I will repeat what I have said before. He will not be around for South Carolina. How is he going to do well in South Carolina against Donald Trump, Nikki Haley, and Tim Scott? He'll be lucky to be fourth. He'll be out of it, I think, before South Carolina, but definitely after South Carolina. This guy cannot recover. Just like Ed Muskie could not recover, he cannot recover. And what scares the hell out of me is what I said last week, that he's going to come back to Florida and he's going to get the legislature, who he owns, to propose and pass a proposed constitutional amendment to do away with the two-term limits for the governorship in the state of Florida Constitution so he can run for a third term and run for president in 2028. That's his backup plan. I don't even think Republicans will vote for that on a ballot initiative, but it clearly won't pass in this state. But he'll try. You watch. He will try. He is disintegrating before our very eyes. You don't like people, and they don't like you. You don't get elected. And Donald's going to find that out if he becomes the candidate. I don't care what this new poll says. Republicans saying they will vote for him is fine until they walk in the booth, like in 2020 and like in 2022 when he was on the ballot, even though his name wasn't on the ballot. People just won't vote for him or candidates. That they'll stay home. They won't vote for Biden. They'll stay home. I'm not buying this 44-44 pie thing. I'm not buying it. I don't believe it. And even if it's true, he gets convicted of anything, he's done. So if I was Republican Party, I'd be looking for somebody else, but they're not smart enough to look for somebody else.
No.
So that's my word about DeSantis today.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a one-trick pony. He's getting out. He's an angry anti-woke. That's it. Yeah. Yeah.
He just is. And he doesn't know how to build a consensus.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks his hard right people in Florida, and they do. He runs Florida like Trump tries to run the national party. That's the way he runs Florida. He intimidates everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And Republicans, you know, and so far he has refused to call a special session to comply with the Alabama case, because he's got a pending case in front of the 11th Circuit, and they're going to tell him, draw a new map. And he knows it. And he is stalling. And I think that, you know, he got to get here, and he's going to have to, he's going to try to do what Alabama did.
Yeah.
Just disobey the Supreme Court. But I don't think it'll go any farther here than it's going to go in Alabama, but he's going to try. Because he won't even have a district to go back to run for Congress again. His career will be over. I truly believe that. We just have to put up with him for another 2.5 years here in Florida. That's the sad part. So, what else you got in mind for today?
Nothing.
Oh, we're over our time, aren't we?
We're past 11, and we got a meeting to get ready for. So
we do. We didn't have any laughs at all today, did we?
No.
I kind of warned that at the beginning, didn't I? I couldn't find anything funny to talk about. I'm sorry.
Right.
I'll make up for it next week.
Yeah, we'll find
something.
I'll make
up for it next week. I promise.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll get out of this bad mood and do something else. Okay. All right.
All righty.
Brendan and I have actual real business to do at noon. and we have some business to talk about once we get off the phone here and move on to another call. Hope you'll be back next week. Hezzy, thank you for your time again, as always.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thanks,
okay.
Hezzy.
Brendan.
Have a great week.
I will talk to you in. I will talk to you in 5 minutes. Have a great
day. Sounds good.
Be well.
All right.
All right.
Yep.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You, guys. Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Brendan. We'll speak to you next week. Be well. Bye. Okay. Well, we're going to move on to the second section on Tuesdays, and that'll be the Yonkers Tribune section. We're going to cover some international as well as national news. Probably the most interesting thing that's taken place is in Myanmar. So evidently, Myanmar's ousted leader, Suu Kyi, has some of her prison sentences reduced. This was totally unexpected, but it's not sufficient. Anyway, jailed Myanmar civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi has been pardoned in 5 criminal cases, although she still faces 14 others. That's what state media said today. So a military coup in February of 2021 plunged the Southeast Asian nation into chaos and widespread violence as the military junta launched a bloody crackdown on dissent. Well, chairman of State Administration Council pardoned Dao Aung Suu Kyi, who was sentenced by the relevant courts under 5 cases. A state media broadcast had said. The broadcast said that the 78-year-old Nobel Prize, Peace Prize laureate still faces 14 other cases. The Tuesday's announcement was part of an amnesty of more than 7,000 prisoners to mark Buddhist Lent. The junta announced on Monday it would extend Myanmar's state of emergency by 6 months, state media had said, which is likely to delay elections promised for August. Suu Kyi, who has been in detention since 2021, has been sentenced to 33 years in jail for a clutch of charges, including corruption, possession of illegal walkie-talkies, and flouting coronavirus restrictions. Quote, she couldn't be freed completely, although some sentences against her were pardoned. She still has to face 14 cases. Only 5 cases out of 19 were pardoned, a legal source speaking on condition of anonymity had said. Well, former Myanmar President Win Myint, who was also removed in the 2021 coup, would also be pardoned in 2 cases, he broadcasted said. Well, the announcement said that 125 foreign prisoners would be released and pardoned. An unspecified number of prisoners facing the death penalty also had their sentences reduced to life imprisonment, it said. Osuki has only been seen once since she was held after the February 1, 2021 putsch in grainy state media photos from a bare courtroom in the military-built capital of Naypyidaw. There had been concerns about Suu Kyi's health since her detention, including during her trial in a junta court that required her to attend almost daily hearings. She was moved from prison to a government building last week, according to an official from her political party. In July, Thailand's foreign minister said he had met with Suu Kyi, the first known meeting with a foreign envoy since she was detained. A junta spokesperson told Agence France-Presse the meeting had lasted more than an hour, but did not give any details about what was discussed. Myanmar frequently grants amnesty to thousands of prisoners to commemorate holidays or special Buddhist dates. The junta released some 23,000 prisoners after the 2021 coup in a move that human rights groups feared at the time was aimed at freeing up space for military opponents. Well, more than 24,000 people have been arrested since the military booted Suu Kyi's government from power, according to a local monitoring group. Almost 20,000 remain behind bars, according to the latest figures. Well, Suu Kyi remains hugely popular in Myanmar, even after her international image was tainted by a power-sharing deal with the generals and her failure to speak up for the persecuted Rohingya, a minority. But many fighting for democracy have jettisoned her core principle of nonviolence and taken up arms to try and permanently root out military dominance of Myanmar's politics and economy. The military cited alleged widespread voter fraud during elections in November 2020 as a reason for its coup, which sparked huge protest and a bloody crackdown. Those polls were won resoundingly by Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy, with international observers saying at the time the polls were largely free and fair. Conflict since the coup has displaced more than 1 million people, the United Nations had said. And according to a local monitoring group, more than 3,800 people have been killed since the coup, a figure the junta puts at 5,000. This is unbelievable what's going on. Truly, truly amazing. But it is just what it is. Ah, goodness. Now, let's look at some other things that you may find of interest. Russia is retaining many allies despite the Ukraine conflict. Despite the military intervention in Ukraine and efforts by the West to paint Russia as a pariah state, Moscow can still count on support from several African, Latin American, in Asian governments, including that of heavyweight China. Well, visibly satisfied, Russian President Vladimir Putin stood shoulder to shoulder on Friday with a score of African heads of state at a Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg. The message from the family photo was, he said, that Moscow was working hand in hand with the continent and its 1 billion people. Russia's attention to Africa is steadily growing, Putin said on Friday. He added the relations with each country on the African continent where the Soviet Union had already forged strong ties, quote, have a bright future in the emerging multipolar world, end quote. Well, the previous day, Putin had called a diplomatic rabbit out of his hat, offering free grain to six African countries, just as the latter were wondering how to cope with the consequences of Russia's withdrawal from the Ukraine grain deal. Well, that pact enabled Ukraine to export its cereal crops to global markets despite the war, thus easing pressure on food prices in Africa and elsewhere. Well, Putin's overture to Africa go back long before the Ukraine conflict. For several years now, the Kremlin has openly engaged in diplomatic and economic offensives on the continent and offered, quote, security, end quote, in the form of the Wagner mercenary army to African governments fending off jihadist insurgencies. But in recent months, Russia has had to speed up its request for alternatives to its European partners. Sergei Lavrov has toured Africa twice since January, seeking to draw it into Moscow's camp and presenting Russia as a bulwark against Western imperialism, quote-unquote, and neocolonialism, quote-unquote. Well, Moscow also continues to enjoy the backing of several Latin American and Asian leaders, including several criticized for their authoritarian rule. Historic allies of Moscow, like Venezuela and Cuba, refused to condemn Russia's military offensive in Ukraine during this month's summit between Latin America and the European Union. In their joint declaration, the leaders merely expressed their, quote, deep concern on the ongoing war against Ukraine without once mentioning Russia, Moscow, the Kremlin, or Putin. Even this lowest common denominator phrasing failed to garner unanimous support faced with Nicaragua's refusal to endorse it. While not going so far as to back Moscow, Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva refused to send weapons to Ukraine or to impose sanctions on Russia, calling instead for Europe and the United States to stop encouraging, quote-unquote, the offensive. Well, Russian isolation is a construction invented in the West, Fyodor Lukyanov, a political analyst close to the Kremlin, advised. Quote, Russia is perceived as a country that might be right or might be wrong, but is, in any case, opposed to the West, he said. Quote, in this new international environment, this standpoint is more efficient and more attractive than one could have imagined. Well, certain countries prefer to remain silent while others speak volumes. In February 24, the anniversary of Russia's military operation in its pro-Western neighbor, a majority of countries at the United Nations urged Russia to withdraw its troops from Ukraine. Moscow's historic allies, Belarus, North Korea, and Syria, voted against the motion, and around 30 others abstained. Chinese President Xi Jinping was received with great pomp in Moscow in March for a visit designed to usher in a, quote, new era, quote, unquote, of Sino-Russian relations. Since then, Russian and Chinese armies have conducted a string of joint military exercises. In another sign of a partnership that is designed to counter U.S. hegemony, is scheduled to visit China in October, his first trip to a G20 country since the start of the conflict in Ukraine. In recent months, the Russian leader has traveled to Iran and Central Asia, but an international arrest warrant against him, issued by the International Criminal Court, may hinder future movements. It has already forced him to abandon plans to take part in the BRICS Summit of Emerging Economies, due to be held in South Africa in late August. So these are some of the major concerns that are taking place. Now, this is really quite interesting. Artificial intelligence-powered robotics solved the global food crisis. It seems the next-gen food robotics has placed itself at the center of the artificial intelligence revolution, the most significant megatrend of the century. It is utilizing the most advanced artificial intelligence technology to help solve the global food crisis in its 20,000 square foot facility that houses some of the most sophisticated artificial intelligence robotics today. Next-gen food robotics, artificial intelligence powered super app codenamed Lily, quote-unquote, could revolutionize the way people order food and grocery shop. Lily uses natural language process in to create human-like conversational dialogue, allowing the app to learn users' behavior. Lily, L-I-L-Y, is being built with its own artificial intelligence language processor and will not be required to link into ChatGPT for natural language implementation or data points. There is an urgent crisis that is plaguing food prices. It is responsible for the catastrophic fall in the global standard of living. And this global crisis is driving food prices higher and leading to massive damage to the environment. It could result in shortages of food if people don't do anything about it. We're talking about the food industry labor shortage and supply chain crisis. There's not enough labor available for food production, which leads to rampant food inflation and massive amounts of waste. The old food industry produces 26% of the world's greenhouse gases. It uses 70% of global fresh water, and it is responsible for 78% of the global ocean and freshwater pollution. Well, the old food industry is one of the dirtiest industries in the world. The industry can't do anything about it because of labor shortage. Labor shortage in the food industry is destroying the profitability of farmers, manufacturers, and restaurants. The whole food supply chain is under stress. It doesn't have enough resources to transform itself. This crisis is undermining food security even in developed countries. There's only one solution to this crisis: artificial intelligence technology. Specifically, artificial intelligence-powered food production technology that uses robots to manufacture food, control its quality, and ensure that there's no food waste to damage the planet. At the Wall Street premiere, we track the most disruptive companies working to solve global food crisis. At the top of our list is NextGen Food Robotics. And these are some of the interesting things that are being discussed, and we'll see where it all leads, because I'm really not quite sure myself where it will lead. Bear with me a moment here as we move on to some other concerns. 1 second. This is unbelievable. The Ukraine update. Moscow says a drone hit the finance center tower. The Russian military says it thwarted a Ukrainian drone attack, but that one device hit a high-rise tower used by government ministries. It also claims to have repelled an attack on its Black Sea patrol. Russia says a controlled drone hit a business center for a second time. The building houses offices belonging to the three ministries. Hold on a second. And the Ministry of Economic Development staff were said to be working remotely while experts weigh up the damage. Ukraine says the Russian capital is, quote, getting used to a full-fledged war, end quote, although Kyiv has not said it was behind the drone attack. Well, the Russian Defense Ministry also says it foiled the Ukrainian drone attack targeting patrol boats in the Black Sea. So let's look at some of these issues. The Ukraine has summoned the Polish ambassador. Ukraine's foreign ministry summoned the Polish ambassador to Ukraine to protest, quote, unacceptable, end quote, comments made by the Polish president's foreign policy advisor. During the meeting, it was emphasized that statements about the alleged ungratefulness of Ukrainians for Poland's help are untrue and unacceptable, Ukraine foreign ministry spokesperson Oleg Nikolenko had said. Polish media had quoted Marcin Przydasz, a foreign policy advisor to the president, about a discussion on the possible extension of a Polish ban on imports of Ukrainian agricultural goods. Quote, what is most important today is to defend the interests of the Polish farmer, Przydasz was quoted as saying. Quote, I think it would be meaningful for Kyiv to start appreciating what role Poland has played for Ukraine over the past months and years, he added. Poland has been one of Kyiv's strongest allies in the war against Russia, but has prohibited the entry of agricultural goods from Ukraine to soothe the rising anger of Polish farmers. Polish parliamentary elections are due later this year. And this is interesting. Only happened a few hours ago. Evidently, Iceland has suspended operations at the Moscow embassy. Iceland has suspended operations at its embassy in Moscow. Reykjavik, the capital, made clear pausing operations did not mean it was severing diplomatic ties with Russia. The decision to suspend the operations of the embassy of Iceland in Moscow does not constitute a severance of diplomatic relations, the Icelandic Foreign Ministry had said in a statement. As soon as conditions permit, Iceland will prioritize the resumption of operations, quote-unquote, it had added. Well, Iceland had announced a decision in June saying that commercial, cultural, and political ties with Russia had reached an all-time low amid the war in Ukraine. The situation did not make it viable for the small foreign service of Iceland to operate an embassy in Russia. Foreign Minister Thordis Gylfadottir had written at the time. Well, Ukraine denies attacking a civilian vessel. It seems that Ukraine says that Russian assertions that it attacked civilian ships on the Black Sea are false, and it has no plan to do so. Ukrainian President official Mykhailo Podolyak was responding to a Russian statement that Kyiv had targeted civilian vessels headed to Turkey's Bosphorus Strait with three unmanned boats. Undoubtedly, such statements by Russian officials are fictitious and do not contain even a shred of truth, said Podolyak. Ukraine has not attacked, is not attacking, and will not attack civilian vessels, nor any other civilian objects. Ukrainian spokesman did not respond to Moscow's earlier claims that it had attacked Russian naval ships with three unmanned drone boats. Russia had previously said it would attack any ships, including civilian ones, entering or leaving Ukrainian ports as valid targets after the expiry of a deal allowing the export of Ukrainian grain via the Black Sea last month. Well, Moscow is vowing protective measures against more drones. Moscow says its defense ministry will take protective measures after the latest drone attack on Moscow's business district. Well, the danger exists. It is obvious. Measures are being taken, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said on Tuesday. A drone crashed into the same glass tower in the Moscow skyscraper district as it did on Sunday, destroying the glass facade over an area of 100 square meters. That's about 450 feet. No one was reported to have been injured. The building houses several government ministries connected with business. Peskov, who a day earlier said the drone attacks were an act of desperation, end quote, quote-unquote, on Kyiv's part, said it was the duty of the defense ministry to make sure Moscow was protected. Ivan Stupak, who worked for Ukraine's SBU intelligence service, told Ukrainian state television that Russia's defense system could not repel such attacks. Quote, the attacks against the Moscow city building are considered incredibly painful for the Kremlin because this shows the inability to protect the heart of the capital, said Stupak. Well, Russia shells Kherson and kills a doctor. Russian forces have shelled the city of Kherson, killing a doctor and wounding one nurse at a medical facility, regional officials had said. At about 11:10 local time, the enemy launched another attack on the peaceful residents of our community, quote-unquote, regional governor Roman Moshko had written on the Telegram messaging app. Moshko said that the doctor was young, having only worked on the job for a few days, and that medics were fighting for the nurse's life. Well, the nursery, the surgery department and the facility was said to have been damaged in the shelling. A photo posted online showed a gaping hole in the side of the wall of the tiled room with debris strewn across the floor. Well, Ukraine is set to export grain via Croatia's Adriatic ports. The Ukrainian Foreign Ministry said it reached an agreement with Croatia on exporting its grain via ports on the Adriatic Sea. The foodstuffs are to be shipped via the Danube River to Croatia and subsequently taken to the Adriatic coast by rail, according to the ministry. However, the amount of grain that could be exported this way was not disclosed. Ukraine hopes the routes will help it circumvent a blockade by Russia in the Black Sea after Moscow canceled grain export agreement in mid-July. Well, the United Nations said Turkey brokered that deal over a year ago. Kyiv hopes to increase exports by land by the European Union. However, several neighboring countries, such as Poland, are also blocking such an overland transport route. Many farmers fear a drop in prices if Ukrainian grain reaches the market. Now, one second. Okay, with you. Following a coup in Niger, the West African Economic Bloc has asked, or has actually resorted to sanctions against a member state. In the past, these have often proven ineffective, revealing the alliance's weaknesses. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, told member state Niger that it had 1 week to reinstate constitutional rule following last Wednesday's coup. Otherwise, the bloc will, quote, take all necessary measures to restore constitutional order, including the use of force, it warned. Niger is the fourth ECOWAS country in the region to fall into the hand of Putschists in the last few years, while the alliance's reaction was unusually harsh. The question remains of what it can do. ECOWAS was founded in Nigeria with the signing of the Treaty of Lagos, revised in Cotonou, Benin, in 1993. The alliance has 15 members of state, with 400 million people living in just over 5 million square kilometers, making it one of the larger regional economic communities in Africa. In terms of size, it corresponds roughly to the former French colonies in West Africa. It also includes two former Portuguese colonies and a handful of Anglophone countries, including Africa's leading economy, Nigeria. On its website, ECOWAS paints a vision of a region, quote, without borders, end quote, that gives its people, quote, access to overflowing resources, end quote, and allows them to live in, quote, dignity, peace, and security, end quote. The emphasis is placed on a common economic area. The eight Francophone countries in the region have a common currency, the franc CFA, which, like its Central African counterpart, is pegged to the former French franc and thus to the euro, an overarching monetary union of all ECOWAS countries, and a decoupling from the euro have been under discussion for years with little progress so far. Powerless against the terror. Well, the regulations also provide for peacekeeping missions. In the 1990s, ECOWAS member states sent troops to end civil wars in Liberia and Sierra Leone. ECOWAS also intervened in Ivory Coast, Guinea-Bissau, and Mali. When Gambia's president, Yahya Jammeh, refused to hand over power to his democratically elected successor, Adama Barrow, in 2017, the alliance sent soldiers. For the past decade, Islamist insurgents in the Sahel, have posed a new challenge to the region. Many military operations with international participation have failed to solve the problem. To the conservation of the populations of the poorest Sahel countries like Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, that helped military coup leaders to usurp power there between 2020 and 23. In 2022, ECOWAS countries agreed to create a regional joint force. In the past, smaller alliances involving individual ECOWAS countries like the Group of Five, the G5 Sahel, had little success. Experts warn that without adequate funding, the force is condemned to be ineffective. It's not just a matter of setting up such a force, but of making it effective, said Islam researcher Abdullahi Sunayi of the Leibniz Centrum Moderne Orient, Leibniz Center for Modern Oriental Studies. Quote, how does it intervene? Does it engage in combat? How is it funded? End quote. And voluntary funding by member states has not worked so far. But what leverage does ECOWAS have? The Sahel crisis is also an ECOWAS crisis. Following Guinea, Mali, and Burkina Faso, Putschists have now taken over in Niger. The treaty between ECOWAS member states includes several sanction options for these situations. The alliance can restrict freedom of movement by closing borders and canceling flights. It can also block accounts and money flow in the CFA currency region. One of the harshest measures is the suspension of membership, and that has happened to the four member states that saw their legitimate governments toppled by a coup. Bounty Diallo, a socialist scientist in Niger, capital of Niamey, said that sanctions in Mali and Burkina Faso have the governments and people's minds despite the economic pressure. Quote, to think that things will be different in Niger and that the government will give in a week or two is an illusion. So while that's a real problem there, that's for sure. One second. Okay. Let me just quickly look at this. Suicide attacks are getting increasingly common in Pakistan. So with the latest blast in Bajor, killing scores, including many children, at an election rally. So looking to the reasons for the trend, with the death toll for the most recent suicide bombing climbing past 50 in Pakistan, the head of the Jamiat Ulema Islam, the JUIF party, whose supporters were targeted in the blast, decried the country's security forces over the apparent, quote, intelligence failure, end quote. Quote, where are they? When will they listen to us? When will they heal our wounds? When will they establish a system that safeguards our future generations, JUIF leader Fazi Ur-Rehman had asked on Twitter. Well, the conservative preacher is not the only one in Pakistan raising his voice against the rise of attacks, including suicide bombings. The Sunday blast in Bajar was claimed by a local affiliate of the Islamic State militia. The Islamic State Khorasan accuses JUIF of hypocrisy for being an Islamic, a political group that has supported secular governments and the military. But other extremist groups are also using suicide to target their political enemies in Pakistan. The nation experienced more than a dozen suicide attacks in the first half of 2023. According to a report by the Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies, an Islamabad-based security think tank, this also includes a bombing in the Peshawar mosque that killed over 100 people, a commander in the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, or TTP, initially claimed responsibility, but this was later denied by a TTP spokesperson. And the Sunday blast of the GUIF rally was only the latest in the northwestern Khyber Pakhtunkhwa Pakhtunkhwa province, which borders Afghanistan. So these are some of the long history in Pakistan. Very, very frightening, to say the least. Bear with me a moment. Okay. Let me move on. One second here. Let me just check if I wanted to go here onto our Yonkers Tribune website for some latest stuff. One moment. This is important local news. Term limits. Petition fails to comply with the requirements of the law. It seems that the city clerk's office has undertaken a review of the petition submitted on July 10 of 2023, seeking to amend the city charter as it relates to term limits of certain elected officials, and has determined that said petition fails to comply with the requirements of law in that, quote, one, there are an insufficient number of valid signatures, two, it is untimely, and three, it is insufficient on its face. The complete report has been provided to the city council that fully describes the insufficiencies of the petition. The complete report and petition are on file and may be examined at the office of the city clerk, City Hall, 40 South Broadway, Yonkers, New York, 10701. A full copy of the report is available on our website, which we show the link to on the Yonkers Tribune article. And this was dated on the 31st of July, yesterday. The source is the city clerk's office at City Hall, and which was sent to us by Herman Santana, who also happens to be the finance manager at the city clerk's office. So very, very compelling and important news. Now, this I think you'll find interesting. The City of Yonkers and Empire City Casino are joining Quinn for the win to host the 10th annual ALS Ice Challenge on Saturday, August 5, 2023. Hold on a second because I see there's an error in the posting. So I want to fix that. Bear with me a moment here. Yep. Okay, that should be corrected. Bear with me a second here. Okay. So hundreds are going to gather trackside at the Empire City Casino's Yonkers Raceway for a simultaneous ice bucket challenge to benefit ALS research. Registration is available on a web link that we've posted on the Yonkers Tribune website. So it seems that Yonkers Mayor Mike Spano, Empire City Casino by MGM Resorts, along with the Quinn for the Win Foundation, will host the 10th annual ALS Ice Bucket Challenge on Saturday, August 5th, beginning at 1 p.m. at the Empire City Casino by MGM Resorts, with the ice bucket dump scheduled for 2 p.m. Participants should pre-register online. There's a link on our website, on the Yonkers Tribune website. The day of, on-site registration is also available. The event, co-founded by Quinn after his diagnosis of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, in 2013 at the age of 29, became a global phenomenon in 2014 as millions of people around the world participated in the challenge via social media. The event continues to remain a catalyst for raising funds to support research it to identify a cure for the debilitating disease. So that's what it's all about. Again, Saturday, August 5th, 1 p.m. for family entertainment and registration, and 2 p.m. the Ice Bucket Challenge. And really very important, if you can attend, that would be wonderful. Definitely, for sure, it would be wonderful. Now let's look at some other things. Bear with me a moment here. I want to grab some other news. Okay. One second. I think we read this already. I said this a few days ago. This is really quite interesting. This is about the Quran. The Quran cannot be burned. The desecration of the Quran in Stockholm, Sweden last month has given way to a strong reaction from the global Muslim community. In Pakistan, Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif called for protest to defend the sanctity of the Quran, while in Iraq, Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani expelled the Swedish ambassador and directed Iraq's Charles d'Affaires to withdraw from the Iraqi embassy in Sweden, an act that signals the severing of diplomatic ties after angry Iraqi protesters stormed the Swedish embassy in Baghdad and set it afire. It is imperative that the Muslim community responds in a manner that is just and upholds Islamic values, including peace, justice, forgiveness, patience, and controlling one's anger. We must stand together as a community and condemn acts of violence through dialogue, discourse, and advocacy. There is no grace in responding with aggression or in a manner that further enables negative stereotypes used to discriminate against Muslims worldwide. So this is an important issue, and I hope you'll concur. I think nobody should be burning anybody's sacred book. It's just so unseemly. I just don't understand where this comes from. Even though there is a freedom of speech, I think this steps over the line. There are other ways of protesting whatever it is that people think is important. 1 second, let me look at something else. This is really very interesting if you hadn't heard. Dr. Louis Perron wrote this article, What to Do When Your Campaign is in Complete Chaos. Well, he's based in Zurich, Switzerland. One of the most underestimated factors in a campaign is discipline. Election campaigns are extremely chaotic by nature. If you formulate a clear plan and strategy on the outset, it helps tremendously in managing the chaos once the campaign starts for good. In an election campaign, everything is geared towards the top candidate. It happens sometimes that different wings of the campaign team fight each other or for the attention of the top candidates. Attention is, however, a zero-sum game. Some candidates fail to establish and maintain order. For others, it's their very leadership style to pitch various factions against each other. This is almost always bound for failure as the top candidate or party leader plays a crucial role in demanding and establishing internal discipline. If I'm faced with a situation where a campaign is in total chaos and time is limited, I try to at least focus on the common opponent. Complete chaos, where everyone is fighting the other side, is a lot better than complete chaos fighting each other. So you could follow him on Twitter. And just so you know, Dr. Louis Perron is a political scientist, consultant, and TED based in Switzerland. He has won dozens of election campaigns in various countries. Now, bear with me a second because I see I made an error here as well. Bear with me a second. Okay, we'll make a correction on this. Okay. Could have sworn I checked all these two articles, but an error is an error and it needs to be fixed. It shouldn't be left in play. Okay, let me look at some other things here that you may find of value. A moment here. Go back to the site. And And this is really fascinating. President Biden says that an Israel-Saudi normalization plan may be underway. Biden's remarks came as United States National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan was in Jeddah, pressing for Saudi Arabia to join the Abraham Accords. So U.S. President Joe Biden said on Friday that a normalization agreement between Israel and Saudi Arabia could be coming, according to Reuters report. There's a rapprochement maybe underway. Biden told 2024 re-election campaign contributors at an event in Freeport, Maine. He did not provide any details, but the comments came as Biden dispatched U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan to Saudi Arabia to discuss the possibility of the kingdom joining the Abraham Accords. Middle East envoys Brett McGurk and Amos Hochstein, special presidential coordinator for global infrastructure and energy security, also joined Sullivan on the trip, according to Axios. In a readout of the July 27 visit, the White House said that Sullivan met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, and senior Saudi officials, quote, to discuss bilateral and regional matters, including initiatives to advance a common vision for a more peaceful, secure, prosperous, and stable Middle East region interconnected with the world. Sullivan last visited Saudi Arabia on May 7, together with McGurk and Hochstein. Sullivan told MBS during that visit that the United States sees an opportunity for an Israel-Saudi deal by the end of the year, according to Axios, citing two U.S. officials who said that the White House wants a deal before Biden goes into full pain mode. The prince reportedly said he wants a shift from incremental steps to one big package that will include stronger U.S. military cooperation. The U.S. officials argue that it is in Saudi Arabia's interest to forge an agreement while Biden is in office, as it would receive bipartisan support. While Republicans support a Saudi deal, many Democrats would only do so if an agreement is made under their party's president, the American officials had claimed. So it's always about politics, one way or the other. One second. And this is interesting. I think you'll find this interesting. There is an editorial, lack of compliance compensates for fare beaters on MTA trains and buses, exacting huge, albeit unaffordable, subsidies by localities and their taxpayers. New concepts, ideas, and attitudes percolate to the surface. Some are long overdue, while others, especially festive services with regard to public transportation, are an egregious insult to civility and create ever greater municipal deficits, whether in Westchester County or in New York City boroughs. There are presently well-ensconced people with law enforcement backgrounds who evidently have not formulated a response to the ever-growing number of people who do not pay for riding on public transport. For those who do, particularly when using buses in Westchester County, it is impossible to not notice how many people board a bus but do not pay. Westchester buses, as far as I know, because I have not taken buses on every route, are designed with an entry point and an exit point, which is at the front of the bus. And the scenario is a bit different in New York's five boroughs, because there is the front of the bus, which is intended as both an entrance point for passengers to pay a fare, as well as an exit point. And toward the rear of the bus is an exit point intended to make it easier for those who wish to disembark from the rear of the bus. Alas, attitudes have increasingly changed, at least over the past few years. While there are those who alight onto a bus from the front of the bus, many now enter via the back door. And those who intend on not paying the fare await the back door to be opened by those wishing to disembark. And when they do, a large number of fare beaters abscond with a free ride by entering the rear exit entrance point and keeping the back entrance open for those who alight as fare beaters. It matters not in what borough one finds themselves, It happens in every neighborhood. This robbery of service is rendered to those who not only pay the fare, but also because the cost of living to compensate for public transportation deficits fall on taxpayers, whether they use public transportation or not. In the front and rear of each bus, to collect the pertinent fare would be astronomical. In order to thwart fare beaters, it may be best to refit the front part of the bus with an entrance point that requires payment be made to permit a turnstile mechanism to permit one passenger at a time to enter the front of the bus. The rear of the bus would thereby have a mechanism that would only permit it to be used as an exit point. The cost would be huge, the time it takes for each individual to board and or disembark would also likely cause an increase in transportation time to and from one's destination. The cost of placing code enforcement officers until a new entrance and exit portal can replace the front entrance exit and rear exit that permits fare beaters the capacity to engage in their illegal sector services will also be borne on the taxpayers. Although code officers to write tickets requiring fines to be paid rather than working through the city or the country's or the county's courts to resolve code issues may be the most efficient way to thwart future fare beaters from robbing services and likely to relieve the cost of collecting those fines from those who languish in paying their fines or believe they may not be imprisoned and or pay even higher fines the longer the debt languishes. Perhaps there is even a better way. And what that may be presently escapes me. Is there a remedy for those ever blatant thefted services? Is there a solution? Should buses and subway fares be increased to compensate for the cost of retrofitting buses? Is there a solution for subway entrances? How will these concerns be remedied? Will bus lines in Westchester County and New York City become free fare zones and thereby increase taxes escalating to pay for MTA bus and train services? What do you think? Whether you take a bus or a train or not, you are, after all, paying for these services. Code enforcement officers should be given new tools to spur fare beaters to comply with paying their respective fare. Fare beaters will have to carry valid state identification cards so that the person being ticketed may pay such fines by mail rather than burdening the specific court to resolve such excessive services by fare beaters. Neither Westchester County nor the five New York City boroughs must permit fare beaters absconding with their excessive services. The Yonkers Tribune would encourage the respective executive branches of Westchester County and the New York City boroughs to not immediately jump to fines, but rather to afford those who use public transportation the opportunity to initially comply for a time span of a week or two before code enforcement officers are permitted to issue tickets. After all, enough is enough. So that's the story. That's where we are today. And we hope that you've enjoyed us being with you and you being with us. It's certainly been a pleasure from my end. So we wish you a good day and a goodbye, and we'll speak to you tomorrow. Goodbye. 1 second. Okay.